Good evening. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, David.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask those present to please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. So this evening, we're on the second half of step one. Please help me welcome our panel. We have Shara and David. And let's see, we gave ladies first, but she threw to David. I'm going to read this. I'll read the step, I'll read the paragraph, and then we'll get to listen to them share. So, step one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Let me read this week's format. Okay, so on page five in the big book, we start off with, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not so much take as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business. And so I did. Shortly afterwards, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I have what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. David?
My name is David Uline. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date, February 24, 2013. So this part right here is the first time I read through this, it was moving. I'm pretty sure I cried the first time I read through this, because in the face of everything that was going on, I'm reading through this and I'm like, you know, I'm finally, I don't feel like I'm the only one in the world who wakes up feeling like this, full of guilt, shame, and remorse, and terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, and all those things. And so it says I woke up. And to me, that was the crappiest part. I hated waking up in the morning. You know, if I could just sleep all day and not have to go to work and drink, I would be great. But, you know, waking up in the morning was the hardest daggone thing to do. This had to be stopped. I told myself so many times for probably the better portion of 10 years. Tomorrow's going to be different. I'm not going to drink tomorrow. And it would just happen over and over and over again. This part, the very next sentence, I can't relate with. It said that I saw I could not take as so much one drink. I never identified with that. I never knew that I was an alcoholic. To me, my life was the normal one. You know, I didn't drink any more, any less than any other construction worker out there. So it was typical. I had come to terms with the fact that when I died, no matter if it was in a year or 10 years, that I was going to die with a Budweiser in one hand and a bottle of pretty much whiskey in the other hand, or whatever I could afford at the time. And that was normal to me. I never once during the course of from the time I started drinking when I was 13 every day on a daily basis when I was 18 and stopped at 34, I never once thought I might be an alcoholic. I never understood that once I start to drink, I can't stop. It never happened to me. I just kept on drinking. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises. I saw this thing on social media the other day, and I lost it. It's a picture of a cake. And it says, "I'm sorry I blacked out, tried to kill you, and almost got us arrested." That was the story of my life. That was, let's make an amends by cake. And that was absolutely fitting, because so many times, that was the story of my life. Or not almost got us arrested, but got us arrested. You know, I really trying to figure out how many times I told my mom or my fiance or my sister or my employer, "I'm sorry, I won't do it tomorrow." It's like trying to figure out how many cases of beer I drank in my life. It's impossible. So many times. But the kicker is that most of those times when I said that I promised that I'm not going to show up to your birthday party drunk, Mom, I honestly meant it. At that very point in time, I really honestly meant that I did not want to show up to her birthday party drunk. But being a chronic alcoholic, I have no choice in the matter. But my wife observed that this time I'm in business, and so I did. You know, I was a daily drinker. The longest in the course of my drinking career that I was ever able to stay sober was the time that I was spending in jail. I had 2 days where I was out of money and out of ideas, and nobody would give me money, and so I couldn't get any alcohol, and I literally slept for 2 days straight because it was the worst feeling in the entire world, not being able to buy alcohol, and I didn't go to work and I didn't do anything, and then my dad came over and he felt sorry for me because I slept for 48 hours, and he said, here's some money, go get drunk, and then I was alive again. This plate, what it says is, there had been no fight. This was one of the biggest part of this for me to internally fight, because I am an ultra competitive kind of person. I was raised around multiple athletics throughout the course of my life, and still to this day, you know, I'm very involved with athletics and competitive sports and that. And not being able to figure out how to win it was morally and everything destructive. I've always been a sore loser. I don't like to lose. When I was involved in sports, I will tell you that I'm the worst baseball player you have ever seen in your entire life. I played baseball for 1 month and I was like, I suck. I'm done with this sport. I have 18 others that I'm great at, so that's just what I'm going to do. And you know, this combating alcoalism, it was just so devastating that I couldn't get a grip on this thing, and that was the worst part for me, is being beat down because I couldn't figure out how to win. With that, I'll pass, Charlotte.
Thanks, Dave.
Hi, I'm Charlotte. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 18, 2013. My home group is in Yorktown, Virginia. We, shoulder to shoulder, we meet on Thursdays. We have a closed big book study, and on Saturdays, we have an open speaker meeting. but I actually got sober here in Norfolk, and it is, this was one of the first meetings I came to, and this was the first meeting that some women got together and gave me a schedule with their numbers on it and really reached out their hands to me. And if I, you know, it's such an honor to be back here, because if you could have seen that girl then, and if she can get sober, anybody can. I mean, it's, and Norfolk is an awesome place to get sober, if you ask me. I could really, really relate to what David was saying. When I read I Woke Up, I got chills, because like David, that was like, I hated waking up. I mean, for years, I would say probably for 10 to 15 years at the end of the last years of my drinking, last 10 to 15 years, I hated waking up. It was just, my eyes would fly open. Usually, I mean, I would pass out probably early hours of the morning and wake up a few hours early later and just be paralyzed with what my life had become. And knowing that, you know, I was going to do the same thing that day. Like, I was going to... And, you know, if I could sleep all the time, I would, too. During school, I would get my kids on the bus, and I wouldn't drink before then, and then I would go back to bed for a few hours and maybe wake up an hour before they got home, and so I could catch a buzz before they got home on the bus. It was just crazy. And as far as promises, you know, to... I mean, the only person that lived around me was my husband, and he drank, too. But he wanted to quit, and he, you know, we talked about it for years. And at the end of my drinking, he would say, "Okay, we're going to quit tomorrow," or you know, he'd say, "We're going to quit Monday or Friday or whatever." I remember Cyndi Lauper came to town that last summer that I was drinking, and I was like, "Well, after the Cyndi Lauper concert, then you know," and you know, he would get home that afternoon, and he would be like, "So have you drank?" And I would be like, "No," and dang it, he would pick up that soda and take a sip of it, and it was like pure vodka, and just disappointment, because he's one of those people that can just quit. I know that now. I thought he was an alcoholic, but he can give it up, but I was not that way, and I knew that I was an alcoholic for a long time. I knew it, and I think I even knew that I would end up dead or in AA. I mean, that was pretty much going to be, I didn't know AA, I had no idea what AA was, so that was going to be like my last, you know, my last effort, but I knew I was an alcoholic, and I didn't understand alcoholism, and I thought that I had just became addicted myself. There's no history in my immediate family, really in my family, of alcoholism. I'm the only alcoholic that I know of, and I thought that I'd made myself into an alcoholic just because I couldn't handle life, and you know, and I felt I was a victim, and I obsessed about that a lot, and I was fearful a lot. I hated what I was doing to my kids and my husband mainly, but everyone that loved me, and I drank over it. And you know, he talks about like going more time than I could go. I had resolve for like a few hours in the morning. That was my resolve, honestly. Like, okay, I can get through one night without drinking. I can do that. I know I can. And then, you know, an hour later, it was like, well, I'll just start drinking later. And then an hour later, it was like, I'll drink water between each drink. That'll keep my body hydrated, and the alcohol won't absorb as much. I'll eat, you know. And then by 5 o'clock, at least until the last few years of my drinking, I kept it till after 5. But it was a daily drinker for years and years and years, unless I got sick or something. And even then, I could power through it. You know, unless I was throwing up everything in sight. Because, like, a bad cold or respiratory, everybody knows whiskey helps that, you know. And it was just crazy. But, you know what, if I did get sick, and, like, if I was on antibiotics or something and I knew that I couldn't drink, that was, like, that proved to me that it wasn't that bad, because I went 3 days when I was on antibiotics that one time. So, you know, I must be okay. It's crazy. And, you know, I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. I mean, I love my husband and I love my kids. And for years, I had a lot of fun drinking. I had a lot of good times drinking. And, you know, but at the end, it wasn't. It wasn't, and I just couldn't stop it. I couldn't give it up. Yep, that's all I have for now. Thanks.
Thank you, Charlotte.
Girls just want to have fun. We're going to continue on page 7 in Bill's story. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. David?
Well, I think this is an understatement that says it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. You know, because again, finally there was something, there was an explanation of what was going on. You know, the willpower, just like the book says, you know, and what it says a little bit later on is that, or let me stick to what's going on right now. You know, for the exception of drinking, I have a very, very high tolerance for pain, a will that is, you know, it's just amazing. You know, if I put my mind to something, I can pretty much do it, no matter what it is. You know, I can't cook. I cannot cook. But I'll tell you, I learned to make lasagna, and that's pretty difficult, I think. I mean, I went from making chicken nuggets and salad to lasagna in 1 week, man. I got pretty good will. Anyway, so, you know, this deal... This deal is my incredible behavior in the face of this desperate desire to stop was explained, and it was nothing less than incredible desire. You know, I mean, I had very, very outbursts of extreme violence, and when I say extreme violence, I mean extreme violence. I was not raised that way. If you're sitting in here and you've never heard my story, I'm a preacher's kid. I was raised from the time I was born until I was, I think, 27 years old. My daddy was a preacher, United Methodist pastor. I was baptized and confirmed. I was an acolyte. I went to Vacation Bible School. I went to Sunday school every Sunday. I was not raised in a manner to be what I turned out to be before I got here. At some point, about 13 years old, I had this rebellious bone going on, and I just completely veered 180 degrees off track. And from there, it was a heyday for me. It really was, you know. I found something that I really liked to do. I hated being a preacher's kid. I really did. I hated walking around with the halo above my head and people looking at me. And I was born in Charleston, West Virginia. And lived there till I was 15, and then moved to King George County, which is 2.5 hours west of here. And it's a small town. And people always knew when the preacher's kid was being bad, and that was the worst feeling on earth. Getting home from school, my daddy already knew what I did. And, you know, the day came where I was like, screw this. And alcohol took the halo off my head and made me feel like a normal kid. And it made me, alcohol made me something, made me into something that I was not. And, you know, like I said, towards the end, I had very, very violent at periods. And it was just something that alcohol was doing to me. It was a mix of the alcohol, the drugs and alcohol, and me being beat down so much. And like I said, I do not like to lose. I'm a very, very horrible loser. AA's kind of changed that for me. But for most part, I don't like to lose. And it was devastating and a horrible feeling to not be able to figure out what is going on. And it turned me into a monster. So it was explained when I got here. In my experience, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I took the steps rapidly, and I got very involved in doing what I was doing. I got sober in 2013. I had not been introduced to AA until 2013. I've remained sober ever since I got here. I've had no relapses. So I don't know. I don't have any experience with going back out and drinking and coming back in. This is my experience. So when I got here, understanding myself, it says I fared forth in high hope. And I really did. As soon as I came into AA and somebody offered me a solution and gave me hope, the first thing that somebody offered me when I got here was hope. And that was incredible, because for so many years I was hopeless. And it was a very welcoming thing when I got here. For a gentleman at the door, I was going to a Friday night meeting in Virginia Beach. And a guy, just some random guy at the door, stuck his hand out and he said, "Hi, welcome." And I'm like, "You don't know me, because people don't welcome me anywhere I go, man." And so it was very, it was a touching moment for me that I was welcome somewhere. And when I went in, I walked into that meeting. It was, like I said, it was my first AA meeting. And I heard a message being shared that absolutely drove me. I can't even, it's making the hair on my neck stand up right now, because it was such an awesome feeling that somebody finally had a solution for me and was telling me, giving me reasons and explanations on why I drank like I did. And when I wasn't drinking for the brief periods of time, the 8 to 10 hours that I was at work, why I felt like I did. And explaining the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I at that point in time, I was like, this is what I want. You know, I came to AA because I'm completely unmanageable. You know, I said when I got here, I was 34 years old. I had a full-time job. I'm a framer, which is a carpenter, but we do all the heavy lifting for all the trim guys. And so I work a full-time job, and also had a part-time job when I got here. I was working 60 hours a week, but with that 60 hours a week, I was never able to pay my bills. Ever. I would pay my water bill and my power would get turned off. I would pay my power bill and my water would get turned off. And it is very embarrassing knocking on your neighbor's door saying, "Can I take a shower?" And I would have to say that is completely unmanageable. Besides in and out of jail, everything about my life was unmanageable. I'm the poster child for an alcoholic, though I didn't know it when I got here. My folks, my mom and my dad live 7 miles away from me. My sister lives 5 miles away. And for one solid year, I did not have contact with any of them. Just because I didn't, they knew what I was becoming. And this is a couple years before I got sober. And they knew that everything was unmanageable, but I told them just to, F off. That I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And they knew it. And they really knew it. So the unmanageability was, it was obvious there. But I didn't see from the inside looking out. I was doing fine. I was where I wanted to be at 34 years old. That's fine. I don't care. But it was, when I look back at it now, it was a sight for sore. I was a sight for sore eyes. So that's all I got. Thank you.
Yeah, self-knowledge. Probably about the time I turned 40, I got sober. I was almost 45 when I got sober. 45, something like that. But I turned 40, and I started to realize I was getting older, and, you know, I couldn't go on like this forever. I started having to get mammograms and stuff like that, and, you know, because you get older and you got to do all that stuff. And I would see counselors here and there, a therapist here and there. I really wanted somebody to give me something, to give me, like, a pill or something, so, you know, because the drinking was a symptom, but I just thought if I can just get all this worked out and everything worked out the way it needs to be over here, then I'll be fine. And if a pill will, I mean, most people I knew were taking pills, and yeah, give me some kind of pill. So My doctor actually did that for me. My husband was on deployment. I've got two special needs kids, and I'm just exhausted. And I never told anybody how much I drank. If I told him, I drank it all. Doctors, anyway. And he prescribed something for me. And, you know, I don't think it works really well when you're drinking at the rate I was drinking. But I remember I started seeing a counselor. And like I said, I never told anybody how much I drank. And they can't really help you if you're not being honest with them. I mean, but, you know, I got a lot of this, oh, you have a lot going on. You know, I got a lot of that pity, and I really liked that. I really liked getting that wherever I went. I got a lot of, I drink if I were you, too. A lot of that. And that was always, yeah, you would. You totally would. Because I got a lot going on over here. But, and so, anyway, I decided that I needed to get a physical. And so I made an appointment to get it, and they drew blood, and I hadn't had that done in years. And I remember I got a phone call, and the nurse called, and she said, you know, she went over just kind of, you're low on this vitamin or whatever. And she said, and you have a fatty liver. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, now, I've told this so many times, and some of y'all heard me say this, that I kind of rearranged it. And when I told, like, my mother, I said, well, she said that means that I don't eat right, I don't exercise, and I probably drink too much. But what she said was, you drink too much. That means you drink too much. And the doctor says you need to chill out on the drinking. Whew. Okay, so, but, you know, I told that so many times, I believed that until I came in here and, like, you know, but I told my husband, he's like, yeah, we really got to go. So I quit drinking for 6 weeks. So that was a few years before I got sober. And I don't remember being, like an emotional wreck the whole time, but I didn't do anything. I just remember, like, it was just, I went to work, I came home, I didn't go anywhere, I couldn't go anywhere because I couldn't, like, be tempted, and there was no feeling in me that this was it. Like, I knew that I wasn't done drinking, but I think I wanted to lose some weight, too, and I really just wanted to go back to the doctor and them tell me that, you know, everything was okay, and so I did, and things were better, and then I just never went back to the doctor for many years until I got sober. I just started drinking again, you know, and it was just crazy. Until the last couple of years of my drinking became an all-day thing, and it was vodka. For years, I just drank beer because I knew how much beer I could get away with, I thought, you know. But, I mean, and I'm talking like a case of beer a night I probably could kill easily if I think about it. But at the end, it was vodka, and I remember my mom came to visit right before I went to detox, and she didn't like what she saw. And I remember my daughter lived across the street. My daughter, oldest daughter, we have a really complicated relationship to this day, but my mom was talking to her on the phone one day, and she said, no, she's not drinking. She's not drinking. And I was sitting there with my soda that was, you know, full of vodka. And when my mom went back, she left, and probably a couple weeks later, I decided to go into detox because things just really bottomed out. And I called my mom on the way to detox to tell her, and she said, thank God. She said, I went home, and I told your father, if Charlotte doesn't do something, we're going to have to bury her. And that still upsets me because, like, I can so relate. Like, I love my parents. Like, I don't want to do that to them, and I don't want to, you know, I would envision, like, my funeral and what my husband would do without me. And it wasn't like, sometimes it was like, oh, they're going to be sorry without me. But for the most part, it was like, I can't leave this to him. I don't want to, you know, I'm just constantly hurting everybody. And I would, you know, I would be excited that, like, if school was out, like if it was a long weekend, because that I could drink that whole time. And I mean, school was, I should be doing stuff with my kids. But to me, that just meant I didn't have to get up and, you know, and I could just, it wouldn't interfere with my drinking. And, you know, an outing for the kids, bless their hearts, was me, like, loading them up in the van, filling the water bottle with vodka and going to Target. And, like, walking around Target and buying them, you know, whatever, even though I could scarcely, I mean, afford it. Yeah, I mean, I can so relate to this. It was just, it was really, really bad at the end. And, you know, it's a terrible feeling. I think you all know that feeling when you don't want to drink, but you know you're going to drink. And I was killing myself, and I knew it. Like, if 2 years prior, when I was still only drinking, like, after 5 at night, I had a fatty liver. Well, you know, for 2 years I'd been drinking all day vodka, so I knew that things were bad, and I knew that I had to do something or I was going to die. That's all.
We're going to continue on page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted by the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand in a hot stove.
So, the more I sit in these meetings and I listen to people talk, certain kinds of alcohol do certain things to people. You know, tequila makes people's clothes come off. Whiskey makes people crazy. For me, whiskey did me right. I love whiskey and bourbon. Wine made me do very, very crazy things. The last time I have ever drank wine, and hopefully ever will drink wine, was because my fiance was out of town. She left on Thursday. It was Sunday. I had already spent my entire paycheck and drank everything that I had in my refrigerator and drank everything that she had in her refrigerator. So my option was the wine rack on top of her refrigerator. So I destroyed all four bottles that were up there and ended up... I like to punch things. I used to like to punch things. People most of the time, but sometimes when there's no people around, I hit walls. And so I decided I was going to punch a brick wall. And the wall decided that he had had too much and broke my arm in several spots. I ended up going to the emergency room. I get home from the emergency room 5 hours later. My dad brings me home. I stop and get some beer. And... after that, so about 7 hours have lapsed between the time I broke my arm and I got home. I don't know exactly what happened, but the police were called. My arm was in a full cast from my knuckles all the way up to my armpit. And that very night, I get arrested for drunk in public and resisting arrest. So in the 12 hours, I broke my arm and I got arrested. And that was the second to last time I went to jail. When I got out, I swore that I was never, ever, ever drinking again. You know, this is just ridiculous. I have a $1,500 bill. I have this stupid cast on my arm that I have to wear because I have multiple breaks. I can't go to work for 2 weeks. This sucks. I'm never drinking again. And that was when I was sitting in the emergency room. And I made my dad stop at the 7-Eleven so I could get some Budweiser's on the way home. I completely forgot. I am defenseless against alcohol. No matter how many times I tell myself I am not going to drink and how much I mean it, or I tell anybody else how much I'm going to drink, it never worked. It never did until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am without defense against the first drink. So many times I have told myself, I have put myself in ridiculous situations, in sordid places, as they say in the big book. I am a recovered drug addict as well. I have been in some very, very, very shady spots. And asking myself the next morning, what was I doing? I am never doing that again. Ever. I mean, I was a traveler too. When I was drunk and high, I would go places. And some of these places were just, I mean, completely, like, I think back now and, you know, I'm not the model citizen, but I'm a pretty decent human being now. And I'm like, what the heck was I even doing? You know, and it's all because of the chemicals that I was putting in my body, alcohol mostly. There is complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. And I have only one time in my entire life accidentally discharged a firearm in my own home.
I have only one time in my entire life crashed a motorcycle because I was doing something stupid. You know, these are some things that when I do, I'm like, that was a dumb idea. I will never, ever, ever do that again. However, when it comes to alcohol, I can't stop. I continuously do stupid things. And my mom looks at me and she's like, what the hell are you doing? I did not raise you like that. I'm like, I know, but it's so fun. I love alcohol and it makes me do stupid things. I am just completely defenseless against alcohol. And the hot stove thing when I first got sober, I let my sister read through this book and thank God she didn't understand most of what it was talking about. But she understood. She called me and she said, this sentence here, what I just read about putting his hand on the hot stove. She said, I've been watching you do that for 18 years. And I'm like, I know. I don't know. You know, if I could, I would, but I can't. And it was one of those things that I had to have the spiritual experience, this complete revolutionary thought change. You know, that they talk about in this book, because without it, I'm doomed. I'm an alcoholic. I'm at this moment, I'm supposed to be drinking. That's it.
Thanks, Dave.
I went through a wine phase. I did. Boxes of white wine consumed a night. And then I went through a scotch phase. Mad Men. I got really into Mad Men, and I would drink scotch on the rocks and just whatever. And we were talking about Facebook statuses the other day. My Facebook memories came up. Sometimes there's just not enough vodka was my status 3 years ago. So, and there isn't enough vodka. There isn't enough vodka for me. But, I don't have a choice. I don't have a choice when it comes down to it. I will drink again. And, I knew that at the end. I knew that I was going to drink, and I didn't want to drink so bad, and I just knew that I was going to do it anyway. And willpower, I've never had willpower. I always laugh when I see that. I've had food. I was in treatment for an eating disorder. I like to shop a lot. I don't know. I've never had willpower. I mean, my dad used to use that a lot, and it was just like he was speaking another language. Like, it's just never worked for me. So I never thought that, you know, just for so long, I thought that, I think that, you know, I tried to control, I tried changing to different alcohol, I tried, different types of control, and at some point I thought, well, I'll just quit one day. One day I'll just get old, and, you know, the fun will stop, and I'll just settle down, and I'll have my grandkids and stuff, and, like, at the end, I knew that wasn't going to happen. Like, I went from, you know, maybe I'll be sitting up, people talk about this, sitting on the front porch watching the grandkids play with a glass of wine, to, okay, I'll probably be the tipsy grandmother. You know, I'm going to smell funny, but I'll be a lot of fun, and, you know. And then it was like, I got sober when my daughter was pregnant, and I thought, I'm not going to see my grandkids at this rate. I just knew I wasn't going to. What can I say? Like, all the consequences I had, I mean, I was dying. It was killing me, and I knew that, and I couldn't stop. I mean, I knew when I came in here I was powerless. Like, I was already at that point coming in, so that's all I have.
Okay, we're going to continue on page 34. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to the alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity, so we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? David?
I love this part that it says, we are assuming, of course, the reader desires to stop. I hate to read. I'm not a good reader at all. But my sponsor that took me to the steps made me read this from the cover to page 57. I can't tell you how many times. And I'm going to tell you what. If I did not have an honest desire to stop drinking, there's no way that I would have read those pages for 5 months. So I did have this desire to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Well, isn't that why I'm currently sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous? Because I do not have an option. I do not have any choice in the matter. One of the things that stands out to me is the first time that when I was in detox, I was three or 7 days sober in detox. And they brought a meeting up to the psych center, and a lady says, well, just don't drink. I'm going to tell you what. That lady was lucky that there was lots of people around, because I'm not paying $225 a day to be sitting up here with all these crazy people if I could just not drink. That is the reason why I'm here. I really wanted to beat the brakes off that lady so bad, but I have never in my life hit another woman besides my sister, and I'm going to keep it that way. So, the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or wish. Almost the definition of alcoholism as described in the Big Book. What sort of thinking dominates, and that is a very, very powerful word, dominates an alcoholic? Because that's exactly what would happen to me on a daily basis. I've worked with power tools and have been for 18 years, and I still have all 10 digits. I don't know how this is possible, because I cannot tell you how many times I have been at work and been consumed with the thought that I am not drinking, or on the other end, I can't wait to drink. I mean, and I'm not talking about just moseying around some yard. I'm talking about being 40, 50 feet in the air, standing on a 2x4 and telling myself I'm not going to drink, with nail guns flying and lumber flying over my head and saws running. And it's crazy how this day I'm still alive. I have only once in 18 years fallen off a 2-story roof. And for 15 of it, I was drunk. I have no idea how I am still alive. But I was dominated. This was everything. The only thing that I used to think about most of the time, besides a couple other things. But really, it was too much to handle sometimes. There was one occasion, it was about 12 years ago, where we were building, I was framing a multi-million dollar house down in Sandbridge, and it was a 3-story house. And it is very simple. If you take a 2x4, it's just 3.5 inches wide, and put it on the ground, anybody can walk on it. As soon as you lift it up in the air, everybody's scared to go on it. I was the fearless one. I have always been fearless my entire life. I was always the guy that they sent to, we call it walking the plate, around the exterior of their house, and it's the hard things to do. I showed up 2 hours late that day. I was still drunk because I hadn't been to bed in 2 days, and they say, Dave, you're on the plate. And so I scurry right on up the ladder, and I start running around the plate, and all of a sudden, I have the thought that, holy crap, I'm not sitting at home anymore. I'm at work. And I mean, really, I was really drunk. And it was what I thought at the time was I was having a case of vertigo. I was 40 feet in the air, standing on 3.5 inches with all kinds of stuff happening around me, and I'm thinking I have vertigo. I need to go to the doctor. Not once did I ever think that I haven't slept in 2 days and I'm currently drunk. That didn't cross my mind. I got a problem. I need to go see a doctor. It dominated everything about my life. Alcohol consumed my thinking, whether it was me not drinking or whether it was drinking. Probably 20 times in my life, I have been so anxious to drink and build up so much anticipation that I have literally thrown up in anticipating the alcohol. It was incredible that I would get off work and I had been thinking about it and dwelling over the fact that I can't wait to drink, that when I got to the store, I was shaking like I had Parkinson's walking into the store, and I would chug 12 ounces of beer and then throw it up and do it again because I had been building it up so much. I mean, this is not normal. Normal people do not anticipate alcohol to the point where they throw up the first 24 ounces that they drink until they can hold it down. And not once did I ever think, I got a problem. It never crossed my mind. Not once. Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into saloon. I was very fortunate in my life. I was brought up, raised. I started working when I was 13 years old. I had a lawn service from the time I was 13 until I was out of high school. I also started framing in high school. So I was always, always, always working. I was very fortunate when I was 27 years old. I bought my first home. I lost that home. That was in Florida. I moved back from Florida, went to detox in 2004 for a drug problem, not knowing that I was an alcoholic. I lost everything in 2004, was able to build my empire back up. I lost everything again in 2011. So in 34 years, 38 years I am right now, I've lost everything literally twice. And not once did it dawn on me that maybe alcohol is a problem. It was always other things. And people just looked at me, they're like, you're an idiot. Why can't you see this? Why? You know, and I don't have a whole lot of friends. You know, I got my buddies I hunt with, and I got my coworkers. But other than that, I really don't have. I'm really not the outgoing. I got to have a whole bunch of friends kind of person. I have my family, and I have my AA family, and then a couple other acquaintances, and that's it. So it was my family that was always looking at me like, "What are you doing, dude?" And I really had no idea. To me, it was the normal life, and I was living it. And you're going to leave me alone? Or I'm going to show you what I'm going to do. And I had people so terrified that my own family didn't want nothing to do with me because they knew what I was capable of. And why does he do this? What is he thinking? And I didn't know. Again, it was me. It was my normal life. It was what I built up, and it was what I wanted to do, and that's what I was doing.
Most of us felt we had plenty of character. I like that because I thought I had so much character. I thought I was a hell of a girl. I really did. I worked really hard. I mean, I had these kids, and you know, the husband's deployed, and he blows up things for a living, and he's in Iraq, and I just thought that I thought I was a pretty decent person. But then I knew I wasn't. Like, at the end, you know, I don't know if it matters what kind of thinking precedes that first drink if you're so delusional in your thinking. Like, I didn't think. I mean, I just didn't think. I didn't let myself think a lot at the end. And, you know, if you're like that, like David, you know, I got a DUI in 94, and that was, they really didn't do much to you then. But, you know, non-alcoholics get DUIs all the time, but they usually don't drink and drive after that. And they probably will tone down their drinking, right? But I didn't. I drank and drove for many. I don't know how I didn't get more. I don't know how I didn't. Normal people, like my old neighborhood in Chesapeake is a little bit of a sketchy neighborhood. You guys have heard me. I mean, I had some great neighbors, but I had some not so great neighbors that were didn't like me too much. I remember there was a next door neighbor in particular that didn't like me. And, you know, I should have been very scared of her, but it's a great idea to start drinking at noon, knowing in the back of my head that I'm going to confront her. And I'm going to call the police, and the police are going to come and tell me that I need to do something about my drinking. And I really believe the only reason they didn't arrest me is because my husband was deployed, and maybe they felt, you know, because I had the kids there or something. I don't know. But, you know, normal people don't plan their kids' doctor's appointments around drinking. I couldn't even make a doctor appointment before noon. Because it would get noon, it would get in the way of my drinking. I couldn't make doctor's appointments for them at the end, and they need doctor's appointments. I mean, two of my kids are nonverbal. My husband's on deployment. One of my daughter started having seizures, and I would drink till I passed out. I mean, why? Why would anyone do that? I just didn't have a choice. I didn't have a choice at all. So yeah, I knew walking in here that I was an alcoholic. I have a friend that she's my best friend for years and years and years and years. She lives in Alabama. And she, just bless her heart, she's never been married. And she doesn't, you know, they seem like okay guys, but then they turn out not to be. But she's got this one guy, and she called me, and she said, well, and he has a drinking problem, and I know this. She's from what she's told me, but she calls me and says, well, he says it's Jack Daniels. That's the only time that we fight at all is when he's drinking Jack Daniels. And I told him, okay, then I don't want you to keep Jack Daniels in the house. But he said, well, what if somebody comes over and brings Jack Daniels? He's not gonna tell. And I'm just like, but you know, this is my best friend. I wanted to be like, run, because he's not even close to going to an AA meeting. But I said, you know what? Do you have a Kindle? Download the Big Book tonight, the AA Big Book, and read this and this and this. And you know, I can't say if he's an alcoholic or not, but you know. And a couple weeks later, she said, well, you know, he bought some Jack Daniels, you know, but I said I've been there, you know, and that's all I could tell her. Like, I manipulated, I told people whatever I had to, and it was okay for me to do that. Like, I felt I was that delusional. Like, it was okay for me to do that. I had to have alcohol, and nothing else mattered, and I would tell you whatever I had to, because I wanted you close by, but not too close, you know, like my husband. I wanted him to love me, but I didn't want him to like worry about me to the point of, you know, getting on me about the drinking or whatever. So,
all right, we've got just a couple of minutes left. We'll go to page 143, the closer of the paragraphs tonight, and the closer of that chapter. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
There's one reason that I'm sitting up here talking to you guys sober tonight instead of drunk. It's because I came in here and got a relationship going with God. I stopped being afraid of what could go wrong and started being excited about what could go right. And started living my life to the best of my ability. I was very, very, very much an egocentric kind of guy when I got here. Why? I have no idea. But, you know, the greatest thing that Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the greatest things that AA has done for me, it has given me purpose and direction. It has given me a reason to wake up in the morning. I lost my dream when I was 15, 16 years old. I never knew what I wanted to do. I did go to college for a very brief stint, but I don't like being inside. So I said, to hell with this. But AA has given me purpose and direction. You know, when I wake up in the morning, instead of going outside thinking about, oh God, man, you know,
drinking, you know, whether what I'm going to drink or what I'm going to do. You know, I listen to the birds and I think about shooting the squirrels and thinking about what I'm going to do today, you know. And it is to start my morning off. You know, I'm back at home building in Sandbridge. I worked in Sandbridge for 15 years and I left out of there for 3 years and now I'm back. For the last 3 months, I've been doing my prayer meditation on the beach to the sunrise. And I'm going to tell you what, there is nothing that any human power could do to force a guy like me to go down to the beach and pray and meditate. It just was not part of my daily routine. It's amazing. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, it's available. If you're willing, if you're sitting in a room and you're new and you don't know what to do, this is one of the simplest things I've ever done in my life. It's a pain in the butt sometimes, but it is very simple. I'd like to thank the Simple Actions for allowing me to come up here and ramble on. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Yeah, that higher power stuff might scare some newcomers. I didn't think God, you know, was there for me at all. He'd given up on me. He couldn't forgive me. I don't know, but he wasn't listening to me. But I was so willing to do what you guys were doing because you looked happy and you didn't look like you were, you know, wanted a drink. That I got a sponsor and she asked me to start praying, and so I did. And I'm with Dave here. Like, I get up in the morning, and it's not like it used to be at all. My eyes fly open. I get up an hour before the kids get up so I can do what you're talking about, make some coffee and go sit outside or whatever, and do my meditation and talk to God a little bit. And I am just so grateful for God's grace and for bringing me into this program because, you know, if you're like me and you could relate to that waking up and just the dread and everything, then you need to give this a shot because my life is amazing today. So much better than I would have ever imagined it. You know, when I was drinking, I always thought, well, this is going to happen and this is going to happen. And if I do this, this will work out. And one day I'll get to this place where everything will be good. Everything will be okay. I'll be where I'm supposed to be and I won't want to drink anymore. And even how I would have imagined everything falling into place to get to that point, what I have today is a gazillion times better than that. And I don't want to drink, and I haven't wanted to drink in a very long time. I don't even think about it. I can be around it if, you know, I don't go out looking for it, but it's a non-issue. It was never about the drinking for me. It was about, I heard a speaker say the other night, the God-shaped hole in me that only God could fill. And I'm just really grateful to be here. This is awesome. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All
right.
We're going to pass the seven tradition basket. Seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seven tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also the intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please. Newcomers, you're the reason we are here. Is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? If you could just get your first name, we'd like to welcome you. That's all. Anybody in their first 30 days?
Cheryl, alcoholic.
Hi, Cheryl. Welcome.
Welcome.
Greg, alcoholic.
Greg, welcome.
Corey, alcoholic.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Dylan, hey, Dylan, welcome.
Welcome. Feels like one more. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. And if you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, just come up to the table, talk to me after the meeting. Nobody's going to run away after we pray. Smokers, please use the butt cans provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. And did I miss anything? Can we thank the panel one more time? I'd like to thank everybody who helped make this meeting possible. After we clean up tonight, everybody's invited and encouraged to attend the meeting after the meeting, which is going to be at this lovely little boutique Mexican
boutique place.
22nd and Colonial Boutique. Yeah, it's very chic. 22nd and Colonial called Plaza del Sol. Could I have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on 164? Devin!
Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
So close.
Power and glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.